Buddy, welcome to a Friday edition Bulldog Hour, and actually a little bit more because it's a two-hour Friday for us until 4 o'clock today. We'll hand it back over to Nick, and Nick and Nick will take you with the zone to 6 o'clock tonight. Giants coming up on 9:40 in the Warriors and the Raptors ESPN radio game for 5 o'clock coverage on the Deuce 790. Tip-off about 6:10 from Oracle, and there's a ton of emails at tdad1@att.net that I'll go over with Christopher in the second hour of the show. But yes, this could very well be the last Warrior game at Oracle. If they don't win it tonight, they will be facing elimination when they head back to Toronto for the Monday game 5. So we'll see how it plays out, and we'll have discussion about that a little bit later on. Our good friend Ron Adams trying to sort things out with that defense, and without Durant, Thompson's coming back, without Looney, defensively the Warriors have real problems, and we'll see how Ron is able to structure that and how the Warriors are able to get or not get things done tonight. For us, Marcus will join us around 2:30, CG at 3 o'clock. And Joe, I will ask you, is Mike ready to go? If you can let me know, we'll, okay. We are going to start, guys, what we had mentioned about a month or two ago. We want to do over the summer, and that is to take former Bulldog football greats and have just an easygoing conversation with them, but included in that conversation, the greatest moments for any individual, both a performance they might have had or the team as a whole, a lot of times tied together. And we're going to start with somebody that we talked to a couple of months ago and is really firmly ingrained in everything that goes on at Fresno State, particularly the QBC, and that is the all-whack performer from the start of the 2000s and our good friend Mike Stovall, who is up right now. Mike, how you doing?
I'm good, Tony. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Mike. It's always great talking to you, and great we have a chance again for about 25 minutes or so. I wanted to ask you quickly, though, up front, before we start, about the great moments you had, and you had a lot of them because it was start of the 2000s where this team was on one of its real highs. But I want to ask you how you're doing with the bus trips and everything through the QBC and all the stuff you're doing to get to the Coliseum. Since you and I have talked, we've solidified 7:30. Is that good, bad, or indifferent for the bus trip?
Indifferent, I guess. Seems like there's a lot of people that wanted it in the 12 o'clock time slot and the 7 evenings time slot. So I think it's kind of, half a dozen one way or the other.
Right.
But thank you for having me on and giving me the opportunity to share personal, but also, what we're doing with the Quarterback Club. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Mike. Go ahead and finish thought, and then we'll get to one other thing on the QBC before we get started.
I was just going to say, we've filled up one bus. We're working on a second bus. I think I have 14 people left to fill up the second bus. We're doing the best tours buses down there, so 56 people on a bus. And I think we're somewhere close to 200 tickets sold, $50 for the bus, $50 for the ticket. Just trying to raise a little bit of money for Quarterback Club and give it back to Tedford.
And I guess the beauty of it is, because you're in the bus charter situation with this, the turnaround is, even though late at night, a rested bus driver bringing you back home. So it is a single day up and back, right?
Yeah, we'll be back probably around 3 o'clock in the morning is my guess. Game's over around 11-ish. We get back to the bus and then get on the road. We should be back somewhere around 3, no later than 4. Just in time for the wake-up call in the morning.
Exactly.
Go to church
on Sunday.
We
look forward to it. Yeah, it's the good news for people who are working on Saturday as well, that they can get a little bit of work done, whether they're driving up themselves or down themselves or whether it's going on a bus or what have you. So there are some upsides, but you are correct. It's a little bit of a trade-off. Earlier in the day makes it easier to get home. Later in the day makes it easier to get there. The good news is, as we've talked over and over again, Mike, ESPN, the mothership, that is huge, absolutely critical exposure for this program against a storied program like SC. So whatever the trade-off might be, to be on the mothership at 7:30 on a Saturday night, pretty good deal, right?
I think it's great for exposure to Tedford's program. I think it's great to see that we're, top 5 contest against USC. They got their backs against the wall as a program. I think for us, it's not going to be as hot down there. So I think it'll be awesome game weather, game time, football weather. So I think it'll be awesome. I'm happy personally for the 7:30. I think it's going to be a better environment for everybody involved.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a more energized crowd because of it. And SC plays a lot of night games as well. Mike, I also want to ask you quickly, QBC, we had talked about it last visit a couple months ago. BulldogFoundation.org, there is a drop-down menu. You can get there any other way for people to get involved directly with QBC that you'd prefer they use, or is that the best way?
I mean, there's board members that are really well connected in the community, Steve and Matt, or Alan and Tim and those guys. If somebody asked me to throw out my email address, I'm happy to do that. It's just allwac55@gmail.com. If they have questions or want to talk through what is the quarterback club, what does this entail, why is this important, I'm happy to do it. I prefer to do it through email so I can work my day job, hang out with my family, and then respond when I'm able to.
Right.
But I'm all in as far as supporting the club. I know what it meant to me as a player in that program. Those guys were not the big wig, you know, donors, although we need those guys. But these are the guys that make up the Red Wave, the guys that run up and down the, you know, California and support the Bulldogs. They work 9-to-5s and, you know, put a little bit away for retirement, but they carve off a little bit to be a part of the program, and it means something. They're not just, you know, giving money out of their pocket, but they're showing up and volunteering and being involved in other ways too.
No doubt. And again, allwac55@gmail.com. If you don't remember that, the tdad1@att.net, the email directly to me, it'll always get you to wherever you need to go. All right, Mike, one of the things I did not have a chance to ask you about, we are going to talk about great moments on field. That's the main gist of this, or whoever we might talk to over the summer. But for you, you know, so many guys are California guys either from this area, from NorCal or SoCal, that ended up here, understandably so, with a state institution. How did you find your way from Nebraska, from a football crazy area, to here in Central California? How did that work?
It's a long story. I guess we have time, but my mom was a single parent mom, and we moved around for her job as a civilian. So we moved from Texas to Arkansas, two places. Nebraska is where I wound up going to high school for 2 years. Had a great program out there. Did very well. We were state runner up my junior year and the state champions my senior year. And the program, I don't think, has won a state championship since our 96 state champions. But Coach Sir, my head coach, was very involved with the local coaches and that coached at 1, 2, and 3 divisions and the junior colleges. And he's in the Hall of Fame himself. So he's very well respected as a coach in the high school ranks. He was friends with a head coach at Wayne State, Coach Wagner. And when Wagner got the opportunity to come on board with Coach Hill, he called me up. He'd already been recruiting me, and he called me up, and they'd had just amazing, you know, Division II record-breaking couple seasons. They had a couple guys go to the NFL from Wayne State, and they were high-flying, fun offense, and I wanted to be a part of that. That's kind of the offense we ran in high school, so it made a lot of sense. And when he got the opportunity to come out here, I had already made my mind up that I was going to go to Colorado State, and I'd already taken a trip and kind of headed down that path, and kind of threw me a curveball and said, hey, come out to California and check out, you know, the beach and everything else. And that was kind of our joke for 5 years.
Yeah, well, Lost Lake. I mean, just
Reedley Beach, maybe, but
that's always the deal. Exactly. The guys even from California say, well, I thought there was a beach there. I thought that was the case.
We quickly understand that there is no water with a beach connected to it for miles around. So, but you know, I think what really sold me was Coach Hill's. You know, he's an opportunist. He truly does bleed Bulldog red, and he really sold the program and where we're going to take the program. And he held up his end of the bargain, and I was just trying to hold up mine. You know,
I'm glad you brought it up with Pat, because you know he has a great affinity for O linemen, for centers, for anybody on the O line, because that was his experience as a player, and obviously he's coached at the highest level, as you know, the National Football League, as a line coach. Yep. Did you hit it off right away? Because I've always sensed you were Pat's kind of guy. You were a no nonsense, a rugged guy who came into the program. Was there any clash at all, or was it, hey, you know what, this is my kind of coach?
No, I got chills from the first time I met him. He talked about reality. I was an undersized, strong, slow, unathletic center, and he said, you know, do you want to? We're going to turn you into a player. And I said, great. I'm kind of got through life with just attitude and hard work, and I wanted to outwork the other guy and know his tendencies, study film, which is right up his alley, and come to work every day with my lunch pail and, you know, try to outwork the other guy across from me. And nine and a half times out of 10, they were more athletic than me. But if I could, you know, play the intelligence game and know my job, I like to win the majority of the time. It was addicting. But yeah, Coach Hill, his attitude and his spunk and his, you know, desire and will to win and to bring this program back to relevance, that was the overwhelming connection that we had together. Is I wanted to bring a program from pretty much nothing that it had kind of dwindled down to into something that we could all be, you know, we could all kind of look back on and say, you know, we did that. That really connected the dots for me.
Which, yeah, Mike, it's,
you know,
a great.
Go ahead.
No, I was saying it's a great point because, and I wanted to touch upon it. When Pat came in, and Jim had done such a great job, but the last 3 years or so, as Jim had said, the mind was willing, the body just was not, and there was the disastrous JC group that did not work out. So when Pat came in for 97, the program had to be rebuilt, and one of the things he said was, I'm not going to take anybody's word for anybody who is already here. With my own eyes, I'm going to figure this out. Whoever wants to be here will be here. Whoever doesn't want to be here, I'll try to get them somewhere else. But I want guys that want it as bad as I do. You were part of that first group that came in just a few years later as the rebuild. Teddy had left, of course. He was part of the rebuild when it started. How much was it that you knew the culture was? Everybody had to want it as bad as that head coach. That's all there was to it.
Well, I'm getting chills of just, you know, hearing you describe it, but it was, I mean, it was a circle the wagon moment almost every week. I mean, it meant a lot to us. And to this day, if I see a coffee table in Coach Hill's house, he probably has our picture of the first class that he recruited, because that was a special class. Those guys came in, we all came in knowing that and understanding that we were going to play. It wasn't because necessarily we were the most talented, recruits that could have ever come to Fresno State, but we were the guys that were filling in the gaps of the guys that were leaving. And we lost, I don't even know how many guys we lost that were there when we got there, but it seemed like every day one or two guys weren't in the lockers that were there the day before. And it was a total house cleaning. And, you know, we've talked about it since then, and there's a couple guys that maybe he made a mistake on or whatnot, but at the time he had to right the ship. And it wasn't a 6% correction. It was a 50% correction. In the Navy terms, they say you can only turn a ship six degrees without, you know, sinking it. Coach Hill couldn't wait for that. He had to turn it around right away. And I think at our first year, I want to say there was 50 to 60 true freshmen and redshirt freshmen that traveled on that program, the traveling squad. It was like 50 or 60. Were either true freshmen or a redshirt freshman. And I mean, every game there was guys that, you know, I remember Jake Proch going against Kyle Turley in San Diego State, and it's just getting whooped. But I mean, he lined up every play and came right after the guy again. And, you know, Kyle Turley, 6'10", seemed like, you know, 350 pounds or so, wound up playing in the NFL, and Jake is 6'1", 6'2", 240, just getting thrown around like a rag doll. But, you know, those are the guys that were committed to the program, and we wouldn't give up for any reason.
When did you know, Mike, that you could not only play at the D1 level, but be a standout, be an all-WAC performer? At what point did you say, because everybody has that moment, I don't care how good you were in high school, same when you in college and go to the pros. When you take the step up the next level, you have to believe it yourself. Where was it where you said, you know what, I got this. I know I can do this at this level and not only survive it, but actually achieve to the highest level.
I got to be honest with you. I probably wouldn't have given myself, in my own mind, I wouldn't have given myself the all whack honors, because I felt like there was another guy that we played against that was better than me. But I'll take it. I mean, if coaches decide on that, they know better than I do. But I kind of felt, you sent that question over. I kind of felt the same way in high school as when I got the All-State honor. It was like, really? You don't really think of yourself, can I do this, and this to get all conference? It's kind of a, having left the team after my junior year and Coach Hill and Coach Wags having me come back. And there's just a whole bunch of things that aligned themselves for that year. And it was a special year. And at the end of the season, I was very proud of my resume. But I didn't realize that I was necessarily the best center out there. Nor would I have probably voted myself the best center, but I think as far as competing at a high level, I knew the guys that were next to me were as good as me or better. And I tried to do my best to be educated in what's coming up down the line, what the tendencies are on the D line and what the linebackers and DBs like to do, and be able to think out ahead of our play and see what their reaction could be. And I think there was a great communication with those guys on the line. One of the most special lines I've ever been a part of. So it just all clicked that year. I think it was a culmination of, honestly, me maybe getting lucky. Because I think there was one or two other guys that were just as good as me.
We're talking to Mike Stovall about great times on the field and around the team, and we'll do this with guys throughout the summer. Mike, you brought something up earlier. You talked about the Navy. We, of course, yesterday passed the 75th anniversary of D-Day. My son is a nuclear engineer in the Navy, and so when I wake up in the morning and I see that a Russian ship and a U.S. ship were very close to one another, that definitely gets my attention, meaning things that, and I'm 62 years old, so I've been aware of this stuff, obviously, since Vietnam days. But
you're a young buck.
Yeah, that's right. I keep saying, I tell Pat Hill that. That's about the only guy I could tell him. Even though Pat is very young as well, we're both going to hit 70 and bounce right back, okay? A little Benjamin Button. We're heading the other direction. But the point is, things that always meant a lot to me before, always important, now have a particular home interest. It is very, very personal every day. I bring this up. And I've talked to a lot of the guys in the 2001 team, one of the great teams in Fresno State history, the what-if team, as Cam and I talk all the time.
Yep.
But
yep.
About the fact that you guys had to experience 9/11 in a different way. You weren't there, obviously, New York, we all know, or in D.C., or the unfortunately forgotten-about part outside of Pittsburgh, which I don't think gets enough publicity in all candor. But you guys saw your lives impacted because you had a team that was riding high, that SI was putting on the cover, that you were eighth in the nation, and all of a sudden the brakes, understandably so, were hit, and everything you guys had done was completely gone from the public consciousness. Mike, what did you learn from that you carry over now that maybe was very frustrating then, but you say, as a father and a husband now, you understand the import of things, that something happened where you said, hey, it really put things in perspective at a young age?
Man, just having you describe it kind of makes my go back to that moment. Everybody knows where they were when those two towers were hit. And I don't care what, our age and older, everyone knew. Coach Hill wanted to win. I mean, we broke every huddle on win, 1-2-3 win. But we also knew that winning that wasn't the pinnacle. It was what keeps the jobs for the coaches, and it gives us a reward for all the hard work that we've done, but that's not the pinnacle. What he really ingrained in us was life and being able to lead daily, do the little things daily, to have a plan, execute the plan, put out your ABCs on a piece of paper or notes or on your phone and make sure that today all the A's are taken care of and we move some of the B's up and, that kind of thing. It wasn't about the wins. It was about, looking across the huddle and looking at Dave's eyes and Rodney's eyes and Joe's eyes and you know, all those guys' eyes and saying, you know, we're in this together. We're not singular. I think that's carried over for me personally. I mean, we're a military family. I never served, but we have a ton of respect for the military. And I think that it gives us perspective on life is, you know, I want my kids to understand how important our country is. We do live in the best country in the world. But sometimes we get caught up so much in the wins, especially as dads now, and, you know, seeing our kids succeed and second generation and, you know, wanting them to do as well as you did. And you got to put it in perspective and slow the heck down and help them in yourself, for yourself, realize it's not about the win. It's about all the preparation and everything that goes into succeeding in life and having a plan, executing the plan. There was a saying that Coach Baxter used to say, that was execution fuels emotion. And if you execute well and you score touchdowns, you get the whole team going and everybody's jumping up and down like a Wisconsin or, you know, Oregon State, or, you know, all those teams that we played. It wasn't the win that was exciting. It was doing it with all the guys that had been, you know, fighting down the line with you.
And that, without question, is that group feeling that can make it so special. And that's why I'm curious, when you look back at the greatest moments you had as a Bulldog on the field, Mike, are there as many about the team as maybe an individual matchup where you said, you know what, this was a day that I owned the guy with a bigger reputation than I had, who maybe his measurables were greater than mine, but on that day I was the guy and he knew it across from me? How much do you have of that vis-a-vis what the team did? Are the two just completely tied together? When you had the big day, it seemed the team did as well. And I guess it applies the entire O-line, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm wired to look at what I did wrong in my head. So
right.
Immediately what's coming up to me is the guys that go up my butt, and a couple times I got my butt kicked. I remember a guy that was 400-something pounds against Hawaii. I don't remember his name, but we ran a zone play, and I tried to get something on him. You know, I'm 300 pounds on a good day, and he just shoved me around like a rag doll. And it's like, okay, well, we're going to opposite that play. So, you know, Dave called 336, and I had to hook him. He's a two technique, and I had to hook him around, and I just said opposite. And everybody in the huddle was laughing because they knew that I opposited because I didn't want to have to go against the lug. You know, Utah, I played a guy that put me on my butt, and I'm sure Billy Bullock remembers this, my sophomore year, either my freshman or sophomore year. And first play of the game, snapped the ball, and the guy set me right on top of Billy. And we go back to the huddle, and he's like, you all right? And, you know, it's like, I just got my butt handed to me. So I think the humbleness starts out first, but definitely Cal was a game that, we took a lot of pride in 2000, I believe.
Yep.
And I just remember looking at each other. There was a DN that Kevin Jordan had to go up against, and he kept running twist plays. And we set it up to where, you know, we knew their tendencies, and we set it up to where he was going to come inside. My linebacker dropped, and I was ready for him. And we got the ribs hurting after that play. It was a very ugly play for him. And then I think Kevin wound up breaking his nose, and just a very physical pounding of a team that is much higher recruited than we were, but we took advantage of kind of the lunch pail mentality, and we're going to work harder than you. We're not as athletic as you, but we're going to win this game. And it's 17-3, I think, was the end on that one. And it's just a physical beating. Oregon State was probably one of the funnest games in my career. There was a lot of guys, I think, before that game, they had some guys that were kind of Alan Harper-esque.
Yep.
And I was giving them respect for their athletic ability. And I would much rather go against the bigger lugs, the Big 12 and, you know, Big 10 type guys that were just enormous because they were easy to move around. And the faster, skinnier guys were the ones that gave me difficulties because I wasn't the most athletic guy on the field by far. But that game, we had their number. We knew what they were doing. They were running a lot of twists and stunts and slants and angles, and we would just call based on what they were doing and their hand stance and knowing the details of who they were. We had their number the whole night, and at the end of that, they were ranked like number one or 10 or something like that for Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, they were preseason number one. Yeah, going into that Labor Day weekend.
They were supposed to be all world, and their DBs gave up. Their linebackers were not having a good night, and it was just a physical beating. We were laughing in the huddle. I remember just those, Wisconsin was, we were down at halftime and came back, and Bernard ran his deal, and you could just tell after he ran that back, getting in the huddle on the field, they were so loud before that, and they just lost their confidence as a fan base after that game, after that run back. And we knew we had them. We had get the throat was one of the things Coach Hill used to say is, if you got an opportunity to grab the throat, get the throat and hold on for dear life. And we throat punched them over and over again that second half. And they had a ridiculous guy. I don't remember his name, but 77 was an All-American, and he was supposed to be, all-world, and he had a bad day that day. It wasn't just me. It was everybody kind of taking our turns with him, and he gave up that game. So there's a couple, but Michigan State was probably a rough game. Boise, I didn't feel like we were physically – inept in any way. I just think we didn't take care of business, and maybe we were naive to the stage, or I don't know what happened there, but that's definitely one that we would all like to have back.
Yeah, we've talked about it, Mike. I mean, if people don't remember, on that Friday night, Bulldogs were 6-0, 8 in the country, and incredibly, Boise State was an afterthought. They were 3-3. They were a mediocre team, relatively new to that stage, and I still remember Dave in the last drive, and I thought that he'd get it done, and the pass got knocked down, and it was kind of a sense of disbelief. You look around and say, how did this happen? And for Boise State, unfortunately, it was a launching to what has become a nationally prominent team. But for you guys, and I've talked to Cam about this, and it's something I'm curious about in the last couple of minutes, Mike, and I do appreciate the time. The Wisconsin game, after you're done, and again, this is September 8th, we're talking about, of 2001. Nobody knew what was going to happen 3 days later. When you guys got back on that plane to fly home, did you look around and say, you know what, we are as good as anybody in the country? I mean, a lot of guys, like you said, that were not five-star guys. Did you look around on the plane for a moment and say, I don't know if there's anybody that can beat us, the way you guys had played for that stretch at Colorado, home to the number one Oregon State team, then to Camp Randall? How did you feel as a group?
Invincible. I don't think usually on the ride home on a long trip like that, you sleep and everybody's kind of knocked out on the way back. I just remember a party. I don't remember much more than that, but I remember everybody excited, having a blast. Nobody was letting anybody sleep. We were throwing ice at each other. It was a good time, but we knew we came, did our business, put in our work, and it was a business trip. I mean, that's another thing Coach always said, a lot of these men, I'm sure Cameron has talked to you about it, but a lot of these like phrases that he would come up with and the coaches had, we've taken into our personal lives, and it's a business trip. It's nothing personal. We are going to win, and we're going to do everything we can to beat you, and we don't care for zero stars. It's not about the stars that game day. It's about the game, and if you prepare better and you out coach and outplay those other guys, you deserve to win,
Right.
Athletic ability aside.
Well, I've proven it on the field. And the last thing, Mike, that I want to ask you about, and again, I do appreciate the time, get involved in the Quarterback Club, gang. That's for sure. Email me, email Mike, allback55@gmail.com. But I wanted to ask you specifically about the decision to stay here in the Valley. You mentioned you moved around some, single-parent household, but at what point did you say, you know what, I want to make this my home, that what you saw in this valley, which has been now played out beautifully for you over the years, I might add. You're very successful.
Yeah.
I know your family's great. I know your career is burgeoning. When did you say, this is where I want to be? This wasn't going to be a stopover. This is going to be my home the rest of the way. This is going to be my kids' home. When did you say it to yourself?
I married somebody that lived in Sanger. And
that'll do a lot of it.
Yeah. After my junior year, I married Mandy, and we had two boys eventually. And for me, I just wanted to call a place home. And Fresno, Clovis area felt like home. And I had good friends out here. I still have good friends out here. And my mom lived out here. She lived in Selma at the time. And she's now moved into Fresno, but she's my family. And, you know, now that my family's grown I am blessed beyond belief. You know, I've worked hard for it, but at the same time, you know, I've had some things happen that were beyond my control and my benefit. So, you know, I'll give the big ups to the man upstairs on that one, but he's definitely looking out for me. But a lot of it's hard work and hard effort or work ethic. But I guess there was after my senior year, I graduated and had an opportunity to work for a dental company, and the price was right. I made a whopping $30,000, and I was happy to jump on board with that much money. That was a lot more than my scholarship check, and got into a sales career. And, you know, one thing led to another. 15 years later, you know, it turned out really, really well for me. And I think a lot of the traits that I learned in college with that program, going through those hard times and overcoming those obstacles and odds and all that crap, it prepared me for a sales job that, you know, as long as I believe in what I'm selling, and right. It can really help whoever the person is get to the next step. It's kind of comes as a natural, but if it's something that I don't believe in, I'm probably not going to stick around.
Well, it's worked out great for you and for Clausen as well. So it's been terrific.
Yeah.
Mike, appreciate it. Yeah. Appreciate the time as always. I can't wait for August 31. And I also want folks to get involved with the QBC, and I'll certainly be in touch, my friend. Thanks again for the time.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Tony, appreciate the time.
You got it, my friend. We'll see you. All right, guys. All right, Mike Stovall, we'll take a break. Come back with Marcus after this. Then CG, the emails. Get to 4 o'clock, then Nick and Nick, then Los Gigantes on 9:40. Got to be better at home than it was on the road. And the Warriors, it better be better tonight at home over on 790 at 5 o'clock. This 50,000 watt 9:40 ESPN. Welcome back to 241 here until 4 o'clock. Over emails with CG from 3 to 4. And then it'll be Nick and Nick until 6 o'clock. And then the Giants limping back home will start a merciful homestand after being gone for the better part of almost 2 weeks. And some might argue they've been gone more than that. But that's a figurative deal, not a literal deal. And I shouldn't even bring it up because our next guest is delighting. And having his hometown team get buried. He's going to tell you, because he's an East Bay guy, that the A's are his hometown team. But let's bring up the Culver City Madman anyway, the king of fantasy at NFL Network, NFL.com, and noted Dodger honk. It's Sir Marcus Grant. Em, how many titles you guys have in the last 31 seasons? Do you want to fill me in on that one? Because I've lost count. Is that just vicious? How about that? You have said nothing wrong. Nothing wrong whatsoever. And I S-hammer you right away, anticipating where you're headed. So what'd you think of the Giant road trip,
I was actually going to compliment the Giants, because I was going to say that no matter how well the Dodgers are playing, for whatever reason, the Giants play them tough. They, you know, whether it's in L.A. or in San Francisco, the Giants give them trouble regardless of how well the Dodgers are doing.
That was nice and patronizing. Thank you very much. I mean, okay, look at the rugged road trip these guys just had. They went to three of the... without dispute, powers of Major League Baseball in succession. The mighty Miami Marlins, who have won two World Series titles, not recently. Then the storied franchise, the Baltimore Orioles. I remember Jim Palmer and Dave McNally, not recently. Then to the Mets, where own Tom Seaver starred, not recently. And the Giants almost broke even on that road trip, Marcus. You have to be very scared right now for that momentum, right? Stop laughing.
Again, I don't know what it is, but somehow the Dodgers will knock down the fences literally everywhere and then struggle to scratch out two runs when they play the Giants.
We'll see. Well, again, 7:15 first pitch, Giants and Dodgers tonight. That is for the division lead, provided this is 19. Take your pick. Okay. Actually, there weren't very many. After the 60s, we spent a lot of time where one team was good and the other was bad, mainly the Dodgers good and the Giants bad. And I don't know why I even brought us there, because I don't even feel like talking about that. Fancy that, huh? Larry Bear is saying, can we extend that suspension beyond July? Is it possible for me to sit out the whole year with this team? All right, Emmer, I want to get to our beloved Warriors here because, you know, you and I have talked about this over the years. Most of the time, particularly as we get along in the playoffs, where obviously you get to greater competition when you get out of the first rounds, etc., by the time we get to the conference finals and now the NBA finals, it's very rare that what we saw last year happens where a team was up 3-0. 90% of the series are going to be 2-1 after three games, which means game four is a linchpin game. With the Warriors, it hasn't always been the case. We've seen them come back from 3-1 during the playoffs. We've seen them also lose a 3-1 lead. I've forgotten the year. Somebody can remind me about that. LeBron will remind us about that. But I really sense, with everything else going on with this team and the fife and drum routine that they're dealing with the health, if they don't get tonight, Marcus, even if Durant comes back, you and I both know he would not be anywhere near physically ready, nor in game shape. Clay is probably coming back on guts alone tonight. It's a dream to think Looney's going to have any kind of play of substance coming along. Does it mean, when you factor all that in, three of your top five guys out, if you don't win tonight, you're not coming back from 3-1? It may end Monday in Toronto.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. You know, and it was a calculated risk, obviously, by sitting Clay out the other night. You know, hope, and I think it was done with the hope that maybe Durant would be further along, so you would come back in Game Four. You would have Thompson rested. You would have Durant healthy again. You know, and obviously that's not going to happen. We'll see what Clay, you know, is able to give them tonight. We'll see what Steph is able to give them tonight. For as much as he had to expend energy the other night just to kind of keep them even within arm's reach, you know, you wonder how much he's got left in the tank. Not having Durant, I think, sort of deflates what they were expecting out of this one. So, you know, I'd imagine you're going to get a heroic effort from the rest of those guys. You know, Draymond will have to step up and be the triple-double guy he was again. You know, and I'll say this, yeah, for obviously not having Durant is huge, not having Klay Thompson or even having him at 100% is huge, but I do think that, you know, some people may be overlooking how much Looney gave them. You know, when you look at DeMarcus Cousins not being able to, you know, go, you know, obviously not being in game shape from having missed so much time, you know, Andrew Bogut not being the player he was just a few years ago. I mean, yeah, they are missing a lot by not having Looney there in the middle to get rebounds and to be an occasional scorer when they need to open up the floor.
Well, it's a great point, and that's why when we talk so much, and I just heard even Vince Carter, you know, mentioning, well, when Thompson is in there, it frees up. Yeah, but more than even the offensive end of the court, defensively, those are three of your top defenders. When Durant is out, because as you know, Durant has become an elite defender. We already knew Klay Thompson was one of the best two-way performers. And Looney has become a very viable, like you said, rebounder, role player scoring-wise, but he is a guy who gives you consistent defense, and you don't have it. And so now we go back to what you and I have talked about so often. So much was made in 2016 of blowing the 3-1 lead after the Draymond suspension. But as you know, when Draymond was suspended for Game 5, the big blow was both Iguodala and Livingston re-injured already existing injuries, though they both tried to play through it. They were hobbled. But most importantly, Bogut, who, as you're talking, was a lot different player physically 4 years ago. Bogut was lost for the series in that Game 5. That took the rim protector away unnoticed. That's probably more than anything what cost the Warriors the series. What happened with Iguodala last year, Marcus, almost cost him that Houston series. they had control of that series before Iguodala got hurt and they got away by the hairs of their chinny-chin-chins afterward. And now here we go again. People talk Durant. They talk Thompson, justifiably so. But the Looney loss is very, very important, particularly when Damian Jones is not ready to go. He had a cameo. They're saying that Cousins is probably 10% of where he's going to be next year, not in a Warrior uniform. They don't have enough bodies. They don't have enough quality bodies. It's not something that Toronto has to worry about, though I had mentioned Nick Nurse said the Warriors were down a few guys. Down a few guys, Marcus. That's right. A few guys. But this is nothing for Toronto to apologize for. And you know what? I don't have any problem with the Toronto team. I have a big problem with the Houston attitude. Toronto's a good group of guys. But what I find crazy about this series is if Toronto wins the series, I think it enhances the chance that Kawhi stays. Or he could say, my work is done here, and ride off in the sunset back to L.A. But, Marcus, what about this Stephen A. Smith stuff I talked about the other day, saying if the Warriors lose, Durant will stay? Do you buy that?
I think it's a possibility. I wouldn't come out and say it with any certainty. But, you know, I think it's a possibility. And I think I would say that the way things are happening in this series maybe gives it some credence simply because, you know, Durant either will not get to play or play very little in this series. And I think, you know, it may be a situation where I don't know if that wants to be the lasting image of him with the Warriors. But like I said, I wouldn't put it in stone. But I do think the Warriors aren't as much out of this sweepstakes as I think a lot of the national people want to believe. You know, and now if you believe these other rumors about Kyrie Irving possibly going to Brooklyn instead of the Knicks, maybe that lessens the chance of there being a super team playing in Madison Square Garden. So I wouldn't completely rule the Warriors out, but I just do think that this is a decision that Durant has not officially made in his head yet, and we may not know it for, you know, a few more weeks to come.
If the Warriors win tonight, and that's a big if, particularly if Toronto shoots the ball as well as they did the other night, if the Warriors win and tie this thing 2-2, Marcus, do you like their chances, even without home court and a best 2 of 3, to get this thing done? Or does even a win tonight still leave you circumspect about their ability without Durant if he doesn't come back to close the deal here?
Well, again, so much of it just hinges on Kevin Durant and when or if he will be available. And I know today Kerr said they hope he would be available for game 5 or 6. But then again, we've heard that for the last, you know, week or so.
Yeah.
If they win tonight, though, I think there's got to be for them some hope. And I think for Toronto, a little bit of maybe an uh-oh, that here it is. We had a chance to go up 3-1. We had a chance to take 2 in Oakland. We didn't get it done. And now all of a sudden they're getting pieces back and healthy again. So, you know, the way this Warrior team has played throughout this run, the way that we have seen them sort of gel when it seems like the chips are down, until they are knocked out and they are still the two-time defending champs, you got to believe in a best 2 of 3 situation that you know, they will figure out a way to get it done. So provided they can pull one out tonight, and maybe the home crowd is going to be a boost to them, you know, without, you know, part ownership there harassing Kyle Lowry on the sideline, then maybe this is a way to kind of get things going again.
Yeah, you're fined $500,000 and you make $2 billion a year. So I know you can relate to that. So. But I'll tell you this, Em. The way the team played the other night, except for Curry, there just wasn't enough offense and the defense was a disappointment. There has to be more immediacy tonight. If there is, maybe they've got a shot, which does beg the final question here, and it's one that I brought up to other Warrior fans. In the last minute here, for you, if you were told that flat out they lose the series and he stays, Durant, they win the series and he leaves, since the team is moving to the Chase Center, since they know they can't replace Durant, you know how the caponomics work. You can't replace him. You can't jump somebody else in. You can't pay somebody else the money you can pay an existing player. Would you be willing to sacrifice this year if it meant a 4-year deal from Kevin Durant so you can keep the core intact? Yes or no?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the idea of being able to say they won 3 in a row and 4 out of 5, knowing that there's a very real chance they should have won 5 in a row, you know, look, if you'd have told 12-year-old me that the Warriors are going to win three titles in 5 years, I would have been over the moon. But now with a chance to win three in a row, I think you take that because you just never know what's going to happen beyond this.
That's what the crowd said there at Lake Chalet the other day when they were asked that. And all I can tell you is I'm still looking at 1976 when I thought a back-to-back was a guarantee, and all I could still hear in my head is the late, great Bill King saying, every time it's Westfall, because Paul Westfall ripped my heart out and threw it on the ground of the old Coliseum Arena, which is now Oracle, and then Westfall stomped all over it. That's what he did. And when I see him these days, you know what I tell him? You ripped my heart out and stomped all over it, and then he waits for security to show up to haul me away. But, as you know, that's my life most of the time anyway. Emmer, listen, I hope you have a great weekend, and hopefully when you and I talk next week, we're headed to a Game 7. We'll see how it works out. Take care, my friend.
All right, take care, Tom.
Go Dodgers. I tried it at the end. It probably didn't work out. All right, we'll take a break, wrap it up, get you ready for emails in hour two on 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN.
For the one who get it done.
Hi, buddy. Welcome back. A couple of seconds to go in hour one. Thanks to Mike Sovall for his time and Joe, of course. And, oh, yeah, Marcus as well. And, again, both he and I pulling for the Dodgers tonight. What a big lie that is. All right, hour two will be CG coming along. Emails, tdad1@att.net. We had a ton to go over. We won't get through them all, but we'll give it a shot. Then Nick and Nick prior to the Giants on KFIG Fresno. Buddy, welcome back. Hour two, the email hour, as we roll through a Bulldog Hour week, the final offering for this week. And then next week, for the first time, no Fresno State event. So we will motor through the summer as well and talk to a lot of people we might not have a chance to talk to during the regular school year. But this will always stay the email hour, and it's always a lot of fun to go through everything we get, or at least close to whatever we can get to in this time, at tdad1@att.net, TDAD, the number one at att.net comes right to me. Also remind you, Giants coming up tonight. They and the Dodgers, 7:15, first pitch from Oracle Park and Oracle Arena tonight. We have the Oracles covered. Larry Ellison will be very pleased. The Warriors and the Raptors game four over on the sister station. The Deuce, 7:95 with a 6:10 tip-off. We'll see if it is the last game for the Warriors ever at Oracle. That will very much depend upon what happens tonight. And if they don't win tonight, if they don't win Monday, it's going to be all over for them. So we'll see how it plays out. Right now, to go over the emails, our good friend Christopher Gabriel, nice and up. To have the split shift on a Friday, his show, usually 3 to 6 Monday through Thursday, but 7 to 9 Friday morning, and then nice enough to rejoin us Friday afternoon because the guy does not need any sleep. He's already told me this. CG, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I need no sleep. Today is actually triple duty. I make a visit about once a month on Fox Sports Knoxville, great station out in the East Tennessee, big audience out there. And I was listening in before that while they had me on hold, and they were going through this list of 20 of the best football games, one of these preseason magazines for football, for college football. And I heard the two hosts, one of them says, my friend Trey Wallace says, okay, what about this game? Boise State at Florida State. And he says to his co-host, what would you pay to see that game? And he said, nothing. Why would I want to go see Boise State? And I thought, wow, that's kind of how everybody out here feels too.
Since you brought that up, and we mentioned it when the Fresno State game was solidified as the mothership ESPN, that happens to be the opening act of Fresno State USC.
Yeah.
That is the doubleheader on ESPN, the mothership, the regular channel, the one that was the only ESPN when things
right.
first got started. By the way, CG, we are rolling up just a few months shy of the 40th anniversary of ESPN television. That'll be September of, you guessed it, 2019. So that means they got to pull.
So will you be, it begs the question, Tony, being that, and we didn't get into that part of it, but it does beg the question, will Tony Diodato, longtime Valley resident, native of the Valley, longtime Fresno.
Where are you headed here? Yes. Okay.
Will you be Mountain West Conference proud and rooting for Boise State in that game?
Oh, without question. There's no doubt. I mean, I know there are a lot of – look, Cam doesn't want to hear that. Ian Worrell. Okay. The battle that Cam has, okay, and I was just talking to Mike Stovall. He and Cam probably don't feel the way I do about this, all right? I'm just trying to be as dispassionate as possible and say I want Boise State to win every game they play and then to lose to Fresno State in a title game. That's what I want, but there are a lot of Bulldog fans that don't feel that way. You know why I want that, CG. I want that because it gives the Bulldogs a greater quality win than on the schedule. Don't go to any. Don't go to the QBC meeting and proffer that agenda, I guess is what I'm saying, okay? So.
Of course, yes. Noted.
Okay. Hey, I want to ask you about something that just came up before we get to the emails. You know my feeling about experts that are running around with just a hot take. You and I have talked about this.
Yep.
Seth Greenberg has been a fine college basketball coach in the past, so he ought to know better. But I just heard the soundbite, and here's the problem with it. It is a ridiculous soundbite, yet it is repeated by the network on SportsCenter, which further reinforces the desire of guys to throw the hot take out there. Paul Pierce does it all the time. But Seth Greenberg to say, well, you know what? If it weren't for that six-minute stretch in game two, this Warrior series would be over already because Toronto has shut them down defensively. You can't say that when two of the best players in the world are not playing. You can't say that. It doesn't make any sense. If this were a fully healthy Warrior team, then yes, you can say it. But you can't say, you know what, they went and dominated the Warriors, and by the way, Durant was out, Thompson was out, Looney was out, Cousins is still hurt, Iguodala is still hurt, but they dominated the Warriors because of their brilliant defense. No, circumstances meant. And it's no knock against Toronto, CG, and I don't want this misunderstood. They're a bunch of great guys, and they'll be deserving champions. But to make the claim that it has been about Toronto shutting the Warriors down would be like having Kawhi Leonard out and Lowry out and Ibaka out and say, you know what, and Siakam and saying, and the Warriors completely shut down that Toronto offense. You can't say that with any credibility, and a former coach ought to know better.
Well, I completely agree. It's utterly ridiculous. I mean, it's one thing to have one player out, but when you have the one player that is right now the greatest player in the world, and if he was in the playoffs, LeBron, one of the two greatest players in the world, and then when you play another game where you have one of the greatest shooters of all time out, and then you have a huge bench guy coming in who gives you great minutes and points when you need it, and a block shot here and there when you need it, you cannot say that. It's like a – I was listening to – I'm not going to even say the name of the show because I can't believe I was listening to it, but I was listening to a national show earlier, and they not only were talking about this series in terms of dominating Golden State, but they were talking about where will it be more enjoyable when Toronto wins the championship? Will it be better winning it in game five, or will it be better winning it in game six? And I thought, you know, this might be premature right now because, again, if you look at game three, which I thought that the Warriors would win, they were within seven without all those pieces. They were still in the game. They were one run away from potentially winning that game. You cannot make a comment. Seth Greenberg, that's just a short-sighted, ignorant comment by him. And as you said, he should know better. If it wouldn't surprise me tonight, and I said this on my program earlier, with assuming Clay is playing, have we heard for sure that he is playing?
Yeah, he's going to give it a go. To what extent, you don't know. I mean, as far as will he survive on the court, yes. Is he going to be himself? Of course not. There's no way he can be because he can't do what he should be able to do in the way of what he runs 2.8 miles a game, whatever it is they say. I got to make one thing clear. It is not Toronto's fault. It is not nobody in Great White Northland should apologize if they go on to win the title. That's not my issue. It wasn't my issue in 2016. The Cavs deserved to win the title. They were down 3-1. They came back to do it. All credit to them. My issue then was that experts did not point out, and I just brought it up earlier, the import of Bogut being out. He was the guy lost that was the sole rim protector of that team, and he was a far different player 4 years ago. He was lost in that game five. Iguodala was hurt again. So was Livingston. I'm not saying those were excuses, but they were reasons that needed to be addressed when they said, well, the impetus of Cleveland coming back was the Draymond suspension. That was only part of it, and I don't expect the fans, the casual fan, to know that, CG, but I expect the so-called experts to go beyond the surface. Either way, if you wanted to look at 2015 and break down what happened when Love was out and Irving was hurt early, fair enough. But let's delve into it if you're an expert. Don't stay on the surface and give the hot take. And then the network reinforces it by throwing that nonsense out on a soundbite. So if you're Seth Greenberg and you're listening to SportsCenter, you go, hey, look, they played my soundbite. That reinforces that aberrant behavior, in my opinion.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's, if Toronto goes on to win this series and KD never gets back on the court and Kevon Looney doesn't get back on the court and Klay Thompson does get back on the court but he's not himself – listen, at this time of year, you're not going to find a player on Toronto or a member of that organization, forget the fans, a member of the organization or a player that's ever going to complain about the fact that they want a ring. And anybody in the media is going to say, will always say, hey, they won it. They had a great regular season. They did great in the playoffs. But yep. Fair or not, it will always come with the caveat. Unfortunately, it's too bad that we didn't get to see what would have happened. I won't say they would have won with those guys, but it's unfortunate. This is the caveat. It's unfortunate that they beat them without KD, without Kevon Looney coming off the bench, and then a depleted Klay Thompson. That's human nature, and that's always going to get added to the mix whether they like it or not if they go on to win.
You're right, and it is just part of the game, and injuries are part of the game, and it should not sully a Toronto victory if that does happen, but it will. And look, the Warriors went through it. They went through it in the series I just referenced in 14-15, the first title in 40 years. Instead of being celebrated nationally as a team that, you know, had spent 40 years in the dregs, it came out, well, if LeBron would have been crewed up, as Max Kellerman would say, he would have won, okay? And, you know, as my late father used to say, yeah, and if the rabbit wouldn't have stopped to take a you-know-what, he would have won the race, okay? There is a bottom line to this, and I appreciate it both ways, but again, my issue is not the casual fan, it is the expert, and that's what Seth Greenberg is supposed to be. And you know what? It dovetails. I want to get to Benny's email, since it came up. Because you and I had talked about it very briefly on Wednesday, we didn't have time. Benny said the contrivance of the Stephen A. Max Kellerman Daily Hype Fest is laughable. It reminds me of the salad days of big time wrestling, during which the bad guy to sell the matches in Central California would suddenly become the good guy a few days later for matches in Northern California, and then vice versa. He said, what a farce of a show First Take is, with its purely invented impassioned clashes of opinion. And what Benny's talking about, CG, is to the core of this whole thing. Is it legitimate? Is it that every single conversation you hear on First Take, somehow, some way, Max and Steven are diametrically opposed? Is that really possible without contrivance?
No, it's not. It's no different than the old show on CNN, Crossfire, with Pat Buchanan and Michael Kinsley. And that was legitimate, but even so, the emotion was insane. When I watched Stephen A. and Max, you just can't tell me. I don't believe in coincidence, and it's point counterpoint. It's the old Jane Curtin Dan Aykroyd bit on Saturday Night Live.
You just can't go quite that far, but Jane. That's as far as I can go.
Yes,
but I know what you're saying.
We'll go with that one. Joe is sitting in the control booth right now, probably going, "What are they talking about?"
Well, we can get to ignorant, but I think we have to stop at ignorant, right? Is that fair to say? Yes. Okay.
But I think, and you know, the thing is, when I listen to Stephen A., I've listened to his show a number of times, just him. He is so different. Yeah, he can be bombastic, but he makes so many more interesting points, no different than Max Kellerman did down in Los Angeles on his radio show. But you put them together, and this is all about TV. It's about ad revenue. It's about ratings. That's what it's about. And I think sometimes with these shows, whether we're talking about Stephen A. or Max, or whether we're talking about the other show over on Fox with Skip Bayless and Sharp, I mean, listen, sports is still meant to be fun. Sports is the toy department. And maybe I've just missed something my entire life. I simply don't understand how people can get just vitriolic, just get angry over stuff. You can have a debate. You can go deep in the weeds with a debate. You can get intense. You can fight for your point, but it doesn't have to be to the point where everybody is screaming. Not afraid of an argument, not afraid to back up a point, but I can't watch that show because it just comes off like the WWE, only the verbal version of it.
You know, CG, along those lines, and I'm glad you brought it up in that regard, and I do understand, like you do, that the soundbite rules. What do you think beyond that? And I'm not talking about what happened with Mark Stevens. That was inexcusable, the Warrior Minority Investor. Inexcusable what he did the other day. I was there. I saw it. It was inexcusable, okay? But what about the fact that Nicole Curran, who is Joe Lacob's wife, leans across to double-check about the drink because she was playing the role of hostess, and she'll be able to do that next year when they get to the Chase Center, a lot better than Oracle Arena, by the way. But she wanted to check with Jay-Z about whether he wanted lime or not in his drink. And she leaned across Beyonce, and she actually, through social media, got death threats because somehow she disrespected Lady Bay. Have we reached that point in society? It's not about Beyonce. It's not about Jay-Z. It's not about Joe Lacob or Nicole Curran. But is it about a society that has lost its mind, at least some people have, if that's what they're going to react to when they have no blessed idea what's going on? And someone, this is like the fourth or fifth time that Beyonce has been there this year, for goodness sake. So you tell me what's wrong with certain people, okay? Just tell me.
Well, I opened my program at 7:05 this morning with this, and I'll say this. I'm going the same direction that you are on this. A couple of baseline points here. Beyonce has 15 million Twitter followers. She follows 10 people. She has made in the time she has been on Twitter since April of 2009, and she has tweeted a grand total of 12 times. The lean across by Nicole Curran. Nobody knows if Beyonce felt like she got in her personal space, but that's not right. The issue. If Beyonce was annoyed about anything, that's not the issue. The issue is the fans of Beyonce calling her the queen. I know that's her big deal, but okay, first of all, Beyonce's no queen. She is an incredibly strong, powerful woman who is a popular singer and has sold tens of millions of records and downloads and what have you. But she's not a queen. She's not a head of state. She's not royalty. She's not a great religious leader. She's not a Nobel Prize winner. She is a singer. And for people to take up for her, the people who took up for her, the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands on Twitter and on Instagram that took up for her, word of warning, Beyonce doesn't care about you. Yes, she wants you to buy her music, download it, buy it, and so on. But she doesn't care about you. Shame on Beyonce for not coming out. When you get to death threats, that it's not fun anymore. That's not trolling. That's serious. And the fact that she didn't come out and say a word about it, but her publicist had to come out, it's not only that societally, Tony, we have lost our way when we are doing that kind of nonsense, but the fact that she couldn't own it. I hope I don't read a statement from her that says, she was unaware of what was going on. That's nonsense, and everybody would know it. She should have said something immediately to her little beehive folks about the garbage that they threw at Nicole Curran. The whole thing is ridiculous, and it really is sad that this is where we have got in 2019, that people can drive somebody off a social media platform because she dared to lean over to see, do you want lime in your vodka?
Well, particularly, and CG, and I agree with you. And I look, you and I both understand this very well. You and I have talked about the LeBron comment that was not, and I'm not a huge LeBron fan. I'm talking about interpersonally. I've always thought that he probably is so Machiavellian behind the scenes, but then denies it. But I am also not someone who's ever going to say he doesn't do a ton for a lot of people. I understand that. But the one comment that he made, I told you, when they were taking for task for losing a final, he had the line to the assembled media, "You go back to your life, I go back to mine." Okay, there was, I thought truth came spilling over there. It was painful, but it was also truthful. The point is, what you're saying, we know that Beyonce would run from 99% of these people that are so dedicated to her, and that's kind of a sad commentary. You can, it's like an athlete, pull for the uniform, try to objectify it, because if you meet the person, you might more times than not be disappointed, right? Doesn't mean you can't be a fan of a team, but understand that the individual that you may idolize may not be. Bill Simmons, who was a terrific journalist, as you know, said that 90% of the time he met his heroes in Boston, they were a disappointment to him. He'd rather not have met them, okay? But beyond that, I understand that Beyonce doesn't want to alienate her fan base. I get it, just like you're saying. But I also know, as you're referencing, that if she saw this context, and this is the fourth or fifth time Nicole Curran has sat next to her, and Nicole was not having a conversation with Jay-Z over Beyonce, which was the perception of some people. You're right. I think Beyonce is obligated to come out and say, "I just want to let everybody know Nicole's a good person. She was leaning over to find out, because it was so loud, what my husband wanted in his drink. That was it. Please don't take her to task." You're going to tell me that wouldn't have solved this problem?
It would have solved it. And this is the singular issue that I have with Beyonce on this. The fact that she didn't say anything, the fact that she has enough people, enough handlers, I'm sure, to make her aware of what's going on, it bothers me that she let this go, because it's almost like, and I'm speculating now, but it's almost like she got some sort of strange joy out of the fact that she was being mentioned all over social media, and she was getting some sort of ego massaging, the fact that thousands of people were coming to her defense over something that they didn't need to defend her over. And I'm at a loss to understand how we have gotten to this point, and why she didn't diffuse what could be a dangerous situation. And anybody who thinks that's overstating it simply hasn't spent enough time on social media. There's too many crazy people out there on Facebook, on Instagram now as well, and certainly on Twitter, that they don't know how to control themselves. It has become a burial ground for the anonymous, where people who don't feel like they have a voice suddenly believe that they can bully and just harass someone because they have the veil of anonymity over them, because they are, you know, tree branch 17963 with no name attached.
CG, I agree. We're going to hit the break. I'm going to leave you with this thought, and we'll come back and talk sports again. All this was at the Warrior game. If Beyonce did not want to be hassled or did not want to have her interpersonal space intruded upon, here's a suggestion. Don't sit courtside. Go to the luxury suites. There are plenty there. She and Jay-Z could have been in the luxury suites watching the game, but then again, guess what would not have been on them? The camera, okay?
Right.
So there is a trade-off right there, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I'm just saying you put yourself in that situation and you know you're a lightning rod in a variety of ways. You have to accept the responsibility, and in this case, as much as it is much more important what happened with Kyle Lowry and Mark Stevens, I do not debate that. There is no debate in my mind about what happened there. It was categorically wrong. This should not go unnoticed in saying that to try to make Beyonce an innocent bystander in this is preposterous, but you know that's how it works. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back with more sports emails, I promised, after this on 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN. Everybody, welcome back. 3:30 here with emails until 4 o'clock. Just heard the promo a minute ago. Nick and Nick coming up to zone 4 to 6. Shortly thereafter, the Giant pre-7:15 first pitch. Giants are back home. The Dodgers are in. Not a critical series in the NL West, because the Dodgers are going to run away with this thing, and the Giants are with their broad shoulders, going to hold up the division as only they can. But anyway, they're going to play 3 at Oracle Park, and so we'll see how it plays out. Also, 5 o'clock over on sister station, the new 790, Game 4 from ESPN Radio, Warriors and the Raptors from Oracle Arena. Could be the last game ever for the Warriors in Oakland. We'll see how it plays out. Also, one other note before we get back to Christopher, the emails, our good friend Gary Cook, his son Ryan, very much a part of the bass fishing tournament, the fundraiser. We've talked about this last month or so for Mason Frulli. He is the 11-year-old who is very bravely battling brain cancer, had a tumor removed, and has come back very, very tragically. We're approaching June 15th. When we first started talking about this, it was back in April, actually. It seemed like a long way off. Now we're closing in on June 15th at Lake McClure. You can find fundraising information at Fishing McClure for Mason at Facebook, Fishing McClure for Mason. Also, you can email RyanCookFishing@gmail.com. Also, you can email Gary, which would be at AgentACook@gmail.com, or call 691-7008 and ask for Ryan. Or if you need more information, just email me directly at tdad1@att.net. I'll get it right to you. This event, this bass tournament fundraiser for Mason Frulli at Lake McClure, approximately 6 a.m. to 3 p.m. on June 15th. So we're just a day and a week away. And last I checked, some 80 boats involved, and we'll get you more information. There's also a GoFundMe account. But it's just such an incredibly worthwhile endeavor. We've talked about this over and over again. Nobody should have to go through this, but particularly an 11-year-old child. This is just something that, whether you're a parent or not, and most of us are parents that we talk to on the show, and certainly Christopher definitely in that case as well, it just rips us apart to even hear about this, and we'll do whatever we can, as we have in the station, has helped out. Thanks to Kevin, everybody there. I talked to Gary about this, but please get involved if you can. Okay, let's get back to our good friend Christopher Gabriel. CG, in email land, I want to get to James at the top of the list and see what you think about this. James said, Craig Thompson needs to step in and stop the upcoming basketball scheduling nonsense that sees Nevada and Fresno State playing only one regular season game against one another this coming season. He feels Thompson should make sure all true rivalries keep a home-and-home conference schedule. Now, look, you and I both know that it's all rotational because you are not in divisions here. You have an 11-team singular conference. Should it stay in rotation, CG? Is that all there is to it? This is the way it should be?
Well, again, one of the leagues that I use as a comparison for whenever we talk about scheduling, whether it's football or basketball in the Mountain West, is the SEC. And they have that problem as well because, you know, it's a bigger league and they want to keep their non-conference games, you know, a good number of non-conference games in. And so you'll play – you'll play some teams only one time. I'm not a fan of that, and I do think you should try to find a way to ensure the integrity of the league, which stems from some of the great rivalries that are in play in basketball, in football, that those don't get damaged, that those don't get altered. And I think with Nevada Fresno State, you know this better than I do. I don't know how long that rivalry per se goes back. Nevada has been the flavor of the month now for a couple of seasons, certainly in the Mountain West, and that's become a rivalry, although I don't know that Fresno State has really had the better of it. I'm not sure how much Nevada views it as a rivalry. I know Eric Musselman did because he just didn't like Fresno State or anything about the whole area. But I sometimes question – I shouldn't say sometimes, Tony. I often question the wisdom of how they are going about scheduling. And in this case, in basketball, just seems like they could do a little bit of a better job. And I know they have a lot of meetings, and every school has their own agenda. Every school has a team or teams they want to make sure are on the schedule. They make sure that they have a couple of games, you know, home and away, and so on. And I don't know that it's a situation you can please everybody. But I wonder just how much input they have gotten, that Craig Thompson and the boys and girls out in Colorado Springs have gotten, and how much they are willing to incorporate. We saw them make the correction in football where the last game of the year was not going to be a cross-divisional game. That was obviously something that came up from a couple of years ago, and it was great. You and I have discussed the football scheduling, and your idea has been with a Boise State-type deal, you know, make them and Fresno State play every year and have it as a non-conference game in the years that they aren't in the right rotation. My feeling has been do it the way the SEC does, where every school you play every school in your division, you have two teams on a rotation every 2 years, 4 years, whatever it is, but one team from the other division is a designated natural rival, and you play them every year. Tony, however you arrive at the end game, I think you need to find ways to enhance and keep the integrity of rivalries that have developed versus what James is saying, you know, let's not have the scheduling nonsense where they only play one time.
The other thing, and I agree with you, CJ, the other thing, I talked to Howerton about this, and Daryl brought it up, and I think it's Conference USA. I'll double check, but I believe they have blocked off the last four games in a flex schedule so that you take teams in competition and you go ahead and pair people off in that last four games so that your better teams play one another. And it might be the third time they play, but you're doing that to make sure you protect the integrity of the league and give the best possible resume going to the NC2As. That is not a bad idea. How do you feel about that?
I'd not heard that, and I normally hear you and Daryl. I always enjoy listening to Daryl with you, and I kind of like that. I've never heard that before, and there does seem to be some merit there. And listen, the teams, you know, only the strong shall survive. The strong, the ones that, you know, that will win out those games and maybe play a third time, it's going to enhance their resume for the NCAA tournament. You're going to be better served by playing a better team when you know you're going to be getting in on that first Thursday or Friday night game for the NCAA tournament. And as a fan and for the TV ratings and what have you, which every conference certainly cares about, it makes for better TV and better games as well. As opposed to having, you know, a 7-23 team coming in on the last weekend of the season, suddenly you're playing the first or second place team. That's not a bad deal, Tony.
Well, particularly if you feel as though the regular season conference champion may not get an auto bid anyway, or may not get an at-large bid anyway, so you're going to have to win the conference tourney. There is no particular advantage of playing a lightweight at the end, picking an extra game up, beating San Jose State at the end of the year, Christopher. Okay, maybe it benefits your seeding slightly, but it probably isn't going to alter your schedule in the tournament. You're still going to have to win three games, so you might as well play somebody better. It's out of the box thinking, and I'll double check with Daryl about it, but it is something in basketball you could do that you obviously could not do in football. That's part of the beauty of being able to play multiple times in a week, right? You don't have the deal where in football you can't turn around and say, okay, let's flex schedule at the end, and all of a sudden you've got a Boise State or a Fresno State saying, wait a minute, this is the third time we beat the snot out of one another this year, and we still have a conference title game to come. That wouldn't work out. This might. The whole thing, I'm going to ask you flat out, because it didn't work out, or at least hasn't so far with Gonzaga, does the Mountain West have to get to 12 here and get into two 16 divisions? Is that almost an imperative here for basketball?
Well, boy, I really think so. And I look to the Big Ten that tried to hold off, as you well know, forever in doing that. They didn't want to, but, you know, for as many people, and I always mention the SEC only because in so many ways they have been a more progressive thinking conference, and other conferences have followed suit. I do think the Mountain West needs to get to a 12th team, and I think when you get divisions going, even though you're going to look at them as a whole by the end of the year, I think it's going to enhance scheduling. It's going to enhance rivalries. And you have the opportunity, as Craig Thompson and Brett Gilliland and the gang out there, to if you can't get Gonzaga, to find somebody that you want to bring in here that's going to be a named school. And that's going to be the tricky part, because I was hoping that they'd get Gonzaga. It would lend not only even more credibility to a conference that I think deserves more credibility than they are given, but they would be a big TV draw, which would put more eyes around the nation on the Mountain West. But if you can't get them in another attempt to go after Gonzaga, if you can't get them, Tony, the question becomes, who do you go after? Because with all due respect to schools like Pepperdine and St. Mary's, Santa Clara, they're not going to do it. They're simply not going to give the conference the 12th team in a way that the conference would want it. So if it's not Gonzaga, Tony, who do they go after? Do they try to raid another conference and go after, you know, it's not going to be a school like Utah, but I'm saying, do you raid another conference and try to, that, you know, another G5 conference and try to bring somebody here? Anybody else that you bring here, you're going to be going after a school that's geographically undesirable. Do you go after a New Mexico State?
That's where I would go. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where I would go. I would go to former conference mate New Mexico State, because not only the geography of having New Mexico in, but the fact that over the years, New Mexico State has been a very viable program for many, many a moon. But you're right about affiliation, and I don't know how that works. But that, to me, would be a 12 team that geographically and competitively would make sense. But
I bet,
you know what?
I bet New Mexico would love it, because New Mexico and New Mexico State like each other about as much as Auburn and Alabama. And
yeah, there's. That
would be fun. I've been to that game at the Pit. I've seen those two teams play, and they know how to get it going. That would be a fun rivalry to bring into this conference.
Yeah, it reminds me, Tracy Ullman, when she heard that there was going to be a tunnel between France, underwater tunnel between France and England. And she said, what are we going to do, meet in the middle and have a fist fight? Well, of course, we know the French would not have a fist fight. They would probably run backwards and blow kisses. He says, joking, a joke, okay. But the point is well taken. I think it would be a great rivalry and would add to the conference, but I don't know the machinations involved. Hey, since we're on the subject, I want to get to Sebastian's email, the Sebby's email. We started to talk about it the other day, but I want to get your view of this. He said it's frustrating to watch. We were talking right after the Major League Baseball draft. That's why I don't want to let it go any farther. Frustrating to watch, you know, players get swallowed up that have a year of eligibility left, or it might be two, but it's just their junior classes going through. You can be a redshirt sophomore and go to the draft. He said, but it's still a lot better system than college basketball. If you had, CG, sincerely, the deal that said you can go, and we know what's going to happen. If you're 18, you can go to the NBA right out of high school. That's up to you. But if you don't, you are locked into college for 3 years. And there's always a way around that you can transfer to a JC and all of that. But as far as staying at D1, you'd have to be in for the class for 3 years until your class gets there. Is that something that's absolutely impossible to do in basketball the way it's done in baseball? It's a great bit, a great template, but does it not fit the sport?
I would love to see that in basketball. I don't know that it would ever happen, because I feel like there's too many agendas in play. You'd have voices like Mike Krzyzewski and John Calipari and Bill Self, and you'd have Mark Emmert weighing in, and you'd have Adam Silver, and there'd be so many voices, and you'd have the NBA Players Association. You'd have the union involved, and somehow they would tie it into the collective bargaining agreement, and it would get so lost in muck and murk that we might never get to a system like that. But I think it's a great system, because if an 18-year-old, the 18-year-olds that are coming out of high school that are legitimate NBA talents and a kid that has a viable shot at making a team, those kids will be told by the right people at the NCAA level and, the more importantly, the NBA level, that you've got a shot. The others who don't, it would be incumbent upon NBA scouts and NBA GMs and directors of player personnel, it would be incumbent upon them to give them the accurate read, or a grade, as it were. And then if a player, Tony, still, let's say there's a kid at Clovis North who still believes, I think I can make it. I think I can do it. Well, it's, you know, it's enter at your own risk. And if you mess up, so be it. But I would do anything to try and implement a system like that. And you're right, there's always going to be ways that individuals will try to circumvent and so on. But I do like baseball system. I think it's a system that seems to work and work very well. If baseball has any problem, it's that there isn't enough incentive for teams to win. And I'd love to see that part of it for baseball change a little bit. But beyond that, for the player side, Tony, boy, I think that would be great, because Is it that bad of a thought? Is it that horrible of a thought that a kid coming out of high school would have to stay at a college for 3 years? Is it really that? I know that when you're coming out of high school, you're thinking that everything has to happen in that given moment. But how many times have we seen players who stayed longer, they came out better developed as players, and they came out better developed as people, Tony?
Well, I know, look, I agree with you. I also know that the altruism sometimes is replaced by the cynicism that says all this would be something to protect the colleges so that they keep players there and enhance the standing of college basketball. The counter of that is, if we're going to be the farm system for the NBA, we need a little protection, right, since it's an unpaid farm system. I guess my question, CG, is this, and you and I had touched upon this a little bit. We know what happened with Scott Boras, and we saw Scott Boras take a player to Japan, which is something we haven't seen happen in baseball. So we can say that's either the start of something that's going to be a trend, or we can say that was an aberration. What is undeniable is if you do this in basketball, there has been heretofore much more viability, as you're well aware, to go play overseas professionally. Does that mean if you tried to implement this in college basketball that all that would happen is a player who didn't sign out of high school, who after a great first year in college just takes off to Australia or across to Europe or whatever and says, you know what, I'll spend the next 2 years there getting paid for it, and then when my junior class bumps in, I'm back to the draft, and then defeats the purpose of keeping these guys in college. Is that what happens or more likely to happen in basketball than baseball?
Well, I think it's a possibility. Of course, you're talking about Carter Stewart.
The baseball
over,
example. And, yeah, and it would be, Hampton would be the example in basketball, which is far more
a
prevalent situation.
There's no doubt. And I think you're making an outstanding point, and I think any system that was implemented, Tony, I think there's going to be a way for a kid to circumvent it, for a kid and his family to say, we're going to try this instead. I mean, whether you have one and done, whether you have, you know, one, and if you can't do it, then it's going to be three. I mean, there's no matter how many different ways the NBA, working with the NCAA, tries to come up with something that is foolproof, there's not going to be anything that's foolproof any more than the perfect crime. There's always going to be something in place. I would at least like to see them make the effort. And the kids who decide to leave, there's not going to be a penalty, but if they decide to leave, realistically, how many are going to do that? How many really are going to come for a year and say, I don't want to spend those last 2 years, so now I'm going to go to Europe. Now I'm going to go to Australia or New Zealand, or I'm going to go to the new league in Brazil. I don't know how many are actually going to do it, but I guess I always fall back. How about we test it and measure it first? How about we at least try something, see how it works? If it doesn't work, we tweak it no differently than when we're tweaking replay, when we're tweaking shot box, when we're tweaking a three-point line. It's better to at least try something and see where you're at versus all these folks getting in meetings for 2 years, 3 years, and not deciding anything.
Yeah, I think you're right. At what point do you call it a trend rather than an aberration? And if it's an aberration, you live with it. If it's a trend, you've got to address it. By the way, our buddy Chris in Seattle, Chris, you're right about Wichita State. That did not work out for the Mountain West. But I think right now I'm in agreement with CG. New Mexico State, obviously the preference would be up fairly close to you, Chris, which is in the hinterlands of Spokane. But if that's not going to work out, New Mexico State would be a better choice. Yeah, I to get back to this point, CG, I do think if it's, like you said, if somebody really wants out, they're going to find a way out. If it's one guy, that's why the Hampton thing is such a big deal, because it's a player that figures to be a lottery pick who's doing this. If he were a guy, like I said, who couldn't qualify for college or was a guy lucky to get paid to play basketball, we're not going to sweat it. We're worried about it because it's somebody who heretofore would usually stay in school for a year. If you're required three, yeah, you know what, after 1 year, if you say I'm more mature than I thought physically and whatever, you'll find a way to get out of it. If it's once in a while, okay. If it turns into preponderance, then you have to address it. But I do think they need to start somewhere. If it was every year you can leave, then does that really mean anything at all to you, or are we just basically saying let's rent a player till he decides it's time to leave? Is that all there is to it if you do that?
Yeah, I think we are. I mean, I've never liked the fact that they got rid of the players wanted to come out of high school and to go to the NBA draft. I mean, and I've always fallen back on, and maybe this is too simplistic, maybe I'm being just a little bit short-sighted here, but I've always thought if you can enlist and serve this country in the military in some of the most dangerous parts of the world, my goodness, if you have talent to be a basketball player and a chance to help your family out, a legitimate chance to make the NBA, why shouldn't you be able to do that as well? But as far as the program that we're talking about, I just why not give it a try and see what happens? I know that maybe I'm being a little too flippant, a little too cavalier, but I do think it's worth at least a look. And you mentioned Chris talking about Wichita State. You know, I think whenever I think about that even though I think New Mexico State geographically makes more sense, boy, it would have been interesting and I think exciting for Wichita State to have gotten in, because not only do you have back to the 70s in the Missouri Valley Conference. I mean, Wichita State has always been good to great. You can't get a seat in their arena, and they would have brought a tremendous baseball history to the Mountain West. It would have been a great addition. But I wouldn't mind seeing New Mexico State. That would be fun.
We'll see what happens. Hopefully Gonzaga has a change of heart. Probably not. Hey, CG, I appreciate the time as always. As usual, it went by too quickly. I will talk to you on Monday, my friend. Have a great weekend, and we'll see if the Warriors are fighting for survival or red hot at 2-2 when we talk on Monday. Take care.
Thanks. They're winning tonight. See you later.
Thanks. Thanks for that old kiss of death. We'll see. All right, guys, our great friend Christopher Gabriel with you on Monday. We'll take a break, wrap it up, send you off to Nick and Nick, then the Giants and Dodgers tonight on 940, the Warriors and the Raptors over on 790. This is 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN. Go thanks to Joe, of course, on the board. And thanks in hour one to our good friends Mike Stovall, Marcus Grant, and also our great friend Christopher Gabriel for the emails in hour two. Nick and Nick are coming up. As soon as they wrap up, a little bit after that, 6:35, the Giants and Dodgers on 9:40, 5 o'clock, Warriors and the Raptors, game 4 from ESPN Radio. One final note, our good buddy Bob and Madeira asked about the Giant Dodgers tomorrow. Bob, that's a big Fox game, 4:15 on Channel 26. That's why you didn't see the listing, and I'm sure Fox would rather. They could play the Cardinals and the Cubs for us, or maybe Colorado and New York, the other two regionals. But no, we get the Giants-Dodgers. The Dodger fans are pleased about it. The Giant fans have got those bumper stickers out like I do that says, remember 2014. And you better have a long memory about that, that's for sure. We'll see you on Monday. This is KFIG Fresno.